Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Lies My Teacher Told Me when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? That bonds are the exact opposite to private property? That public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights? And that permits are the exact opposite to private business? And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, the Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? You know, there's a lot you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package, and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about this thing called private business. That's the place to start. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we've been talking about Lies That My Teacher Told Me. It's a book written by a fellow named Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N, James W. Loewen. It's provocative. It's entertaining because it tells us the truth about what all of us ought to know and what most of us deep down inside actually do know or sense or feel but haven't quite had the words to describe it. It's the lies that we learned in school, or it's the truths that were covered over or ignored in public school. And I wouldn't just blame it on the public schools, because these textbooks are also used by all of us. You know, if you've got a homeschool and you buy one of these textbooks, you will be teaching your children lies. If you send your child to a parochial school and the school authorities buy these textbooks, well, then your children are going to be lied to. So I guess a question arises, why do the textbooks lie about historical events of the past? I answered that question the other day. There's an agenda out there. We are selling something to the newer generation. We're selling something to ourselves. Or somebody is selling it to us. And it isn't for you to know the truth about these historical events, such as Columbus discovering America. Now, you know, you can sense, your brain tells you that Columbus did not discover America first. They tell us, you know, Columbus was the first man to discover America. Columbus discovered America. Preposterous poppycock. Hell, you know, that as well as I did. When Columbus got off the boat, there were people here who greeted him. So obviously, America had already been discovered. Now, it's true that the Spanish and the Italians and the Europeans didn't know what was here. That's a fact. But to say that Columbus discovered America is preposterous fiction. And then on top of that, we've all heard stories about Leif Erikson and the Scandinavians having discovered Iceland, Greenland, Newfoundland, and had colonies over here in North America. Our history books are just totally silent about that. And hell, those were Europeans, and they were here 200 or 300 years, maybe even 1,000 years before Columbus. So why haven't we been told the truth, you know, as it becomes available? As archaeologists and anthropologists and others discover these sites, well, then shouldn't the textbooks in the next generation include that, so that the next generation gets the truth concerning Leif Erikson and the Scandinavians and the Vikings, to supplant Christopher Columbus as the New World's discoverer? Now, we know this, and we actually have some information in our minds concerning this. Let me give you an illustration here. Let's take the Louisiana Purchase as an illustration. If you're like I am, you went to public school and you heard about Thomas Jefferson buying the Louisiana Territory from the French, and it's called the Louisiana Purchase, and that Thomas Jefferson and Napoleon, the French, bought and sold this piece of real estate over here. And now, let's take a look at the other side of the story. Europeans were forever paying the wrong tribe or paying a small faction within a much larger nation, and often they did not really care. They merely sought justification for their thefts. Such fraudulent transactions might even have worked in their favor, because they frequently set one tribe or one faction of a tribe against another. The biggest single purchase from the wrong tribe took place in 1803. Now, all of the textbooks tell us how Jefferson doubled the size of the United States by buying Louisiana from France. But not one textbook ever points out that it was not France's land to sell. It was Indian land. The French never consulted with the native owners of the Louisiana Territory before selling it to the Americans. Most Native Americans who lived there never even knew of the sale, and indeed France did not really sell Louisiana for $15 million. France merely sold its claim to the territory. The United States was still paying Native American tribes for Louisiana throughout the 19th century, and we were also fighting them for it. The Army Almanac lists more than 50 Indian wars in the Louisiana Territory from 1819 to 1890. 50 wars were fought. To treat France as the seller, as all of our textbooks do, is Eurocentric. And equally Eurocentric are the maps, the textbooks that they use to show the Lewis and Clark expedition. They make Native Americans invisible, implying that the United States bought vacant land from the French, just vacant ground. And although the Mandans hosted the expedition during the winter of 1804 and 1805, and the Clatsops did so the next winter, even these tribes are dropped out of the history books. So apparently Lewis and Clark did it all on their own without any Native American help whatsoever. Now, you know, there's a truth that goes along with the history. Now, wouldn't it be better if we just taught the truth that America bought the French claim to the territory, and then we went into that French claimed territory, fought 50 wars, and took it away from the Indians because we won all 50 of those wars? Well, it's pretty obvious, you know. For instance, let's take a look at what would have happened if the British had not defeated the Argentines in the Falkland War. Well, then today, Argentina would own the Falkland Islands, wouldn't they? So the owners of the Falkland Islands then are the British because the British went down there and won the war. So if the American Indians had won the war or any one of those 50 wars, well, then those Indians would still be in possession of their land. They're not. So therefore, all 50 of those wars that we have in the Almanac then must have been won by the white Anglo-Saxons. The last war was fought in 1890 at Wounded Knee, North Dakota, the last of the Indian wars, fairly recently, 1890, you know, 120 years ago or so. So that's the story on the Louisiana Purchase. Now, we give short shrift now to the American Indians. Let's take another example. Historically, American Indians have been the most lied about subset of our population. And that's why Michael Dorris said that in learning about Native Americans, one does not start from point zero. We start from minus 10. High school students start below zero because of their textbooks, which unapologetically present Native Americans through white eyes. These textbooks are written by white men, not by Indians. And today's textbooks should do better, especially since what historians call Indian history, though really it's interracial history, has flowered in the last 20 years, and the information on which these new textbooks might be based currently rests on library shelves. So it isn't information that isn't there. This information, boys and girls, about Wounded Knee, North Dakota, about Columbus, and about the Indian Wars, you know, it's been on the shelves for hundreds of years. The real accounts, the eyewitness accounts. So why aren't those eyewitness accounts included in our history textbooks? Well, because it does not fit with the story that we want whites, blacks, Mexicans, Asians, and everybody else to believe about America or about our history. There's an agenda out there. You're not supposed to believe the truth. We've got a story. We've got a pre-programmed plan here. We've got a Mr. Rogers neighborhood story that we're going to tell you. We have a Sesame Street story that we're going to tell you. And in the end, it all comes out good. It all comes out good in the end. Well, that's because Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street never have any conflict. And it's just fun and games and all smiles. And aren't you happy, boys and girls? And that keeps your minds off of the truth. Keeps your minds off of reality. That's what it does. Now, there has been some improvement in textbook treatment of Native peoples in recent years. In 1961, the best-selling Rise of the American Nation contained 10 illustrations featuring Native people alone or with whites. Of 268 illustrations, most of these pictures focused on the themes of primitive life and savage warfare. Primitive life and savage warfare. 25 years later, the retitled Triumph of the American Nation contained 15 illustrations of Indians. More importantly, no longer were Native Americans depicted as one-dimensional primitives. Rather, they were people who participated in struggles to preserve their identities and their land. Included were King Philip, that is, Metacomet. He's an Indian. He was nicknamed King Philip. Crispus, a tax first casualty of the Revolution, who also took part black in ancestry. He was half Indian and half black. Sequoia, who invented the Cherokee alphabet, and Navajo code talkers in World War II. Nevertheless, the authors of American history textbooks need a crash course in cultural relativism and ethnic sensitivity, according to James Axtell, who criticized textbooks in 1987, for still using such terms as half-breed, massacre, and war whooping, reserving milder terms such as frontier initiative and settlers for whites is equally biased. And even worse are the author's overall interpretations, which continue to be shackled by the conventional assumptions and semantics that have explained Indian-white relations for several centuries now. Textbook authors still write history to comfort descendants of the settlers. Now, our journey into the history of Indian peoples and their relations with European and African invaders cannot be a happy excursion. Native Americans are not and must not be props in a sort of theme park of the past where we go to have a good time and see exotic cultures. What we have done to the peoples who were living in North America is, according to anthropologist Saul Tax, our original sin. If we look Indian history squarely in the eye, we're going to get red eyes, because this is our past. However, and we must acknowledge it, it is time for textbooks to send white children home, if not with red eyes, then at least with thought-provoking questions. Now, today's textbooks at least try to be accurate about Indian culture. All but two of the 12 textbooks that I surveyed begin by devoting more than 5 pages to pre-contact Native societies. And to their credit, most of the textbooks recognize diversity among Native societies. They tell about the League of the Five Nations among the Iroquois in the Northeast, potlatches among the northwestern coastal Indians, cliff dwellings in the Southwest, and the caste divisions among the Natchez in the Southeast. In the process of presenting 10 or 20 different cultures in 6 or 8 pages, however, the textbooks can hardly reach a high level of sophistication. So they seize upon the unusual, and no matter that the Choctaws were more numerous and played a much larger role in American history than the Natchez Indians, they were also more ordinary. So students will not find among the Native Americans portrayed in their history textbooks any of the regular folks, the regular Indian tribes, but rather the irregular, the unusual Indian tribes. Now, American Indian societies pose a special problem for textbooks. You see, the authors of history textbooks are consumers. They are not practitioners of archaeology, ethnobiology, linguistics, physical anthropology, folklore studies, cultural anthropology, ethnohistory, and other related disciplines. Scholars in these fields can tell us much, albeit tentatively, about what happened in the Americas before Europeans and Africans arrived. But unfortunately, the authors of history textbooks treat archaeology as dead disciplines to be mined for answers. And these fields study dead people, to be sure. But they are alive with controversy, and only The American Adventure, that's the book now, The American Adventure, admits uncertainty. This page may be out of date by the time it is read. Adventure goes on to present claims that humans have been in the Americas for 12, 21, or 40,000 years, take your pick. And as a result, although Adventure is one of the oldest of the 12 textbooks, its pre-Columbian pages have not gone out of date. So they take the Columbus myth and then put it in their textbooks, but they never explain the truth about American Indians and their role, their contribution to the history of North America. They're portrayed as savages. Now, I don't know if you know this, but there were 376 treaties signed by the United States government and the various Indian tribes. So there were 376 separate nations of Indians. Nations, that's nativities. Nations, that's ethnic groups that we call Indians. And those were very diverse people. Out on the West Coast, they have slant eyes like Mongolians. And on the East Coast, they have European features just like they'd arrived from Europe. Some of them were white. Did you know that? That's right, white Indian tribes in North America. Where did those white Indian tribes come from in North America? Where did those pyramids come from in Illinois? How long have people been here in the New World? And why are there white Indian tribes in the New World, if indeed they were Indians at all? There were many different races of Indians. I mean, separate races. I mean, whites are a little different, you know, than the average Joe Sixpack Indian, you know, down here, say, with the Apaches or the Navajos. Now, to be sure, Navajos are an ethnic group of people. But then so were the Iroquois, and so were the Seminoles. And many of those people were as different as, you know, a white man from a black or an Asian. I mean, you know, when you've got Indians out here on the West Coast that have slant eyes, those are Asiatic types. And you go over here to Virginia and North and South Carolina and Georgia and so on, you take a look at the Indian tribes there, and hell, those people are white. Now, what accounts for that? Nobody explains that. Barry Fell does in America, B.C. There is information out there. It's on the shelves, but it's not presented to students in high school. And so a question arises, well, why not? Now, this archetype of the primitive savage, a guy that's not very bright, enmeshed in wars with nature and other humans, drives some of the certainties that textbooks impose on the ancient past. And American history tells of the wanderers who moved slowly southward and then to the east. Many thousands of years passed before they had spread over all of North and South America. Now, actually, a significant number of archaeologists believe that people reached most parts of the Americas within 1,000 years. Let me read that one to you again. When we go out and we actually dig up pieces of ground with bodies in it, and villages and cities. And boys and girls, now think about this for a minute. Did you know down in the Yucatan Peninsula, there's a group of people down there called the Mayan Indians? Do you know that those people down there had an alphabet and that they had cities of up to 1 million people, that they had vast agricultural irrigation systems down there, that they were building buildings out of hewn rock? I mean, hell, you've all seen those pictures. Do you think those people are savages dragging their knuckles on the ground, having just crossed from Siberia? And that somehow or another, that they're just struggling along, fighting and struggling in a primitive way. That's a very sophisticated society. In fact, you go down further in South America, down to the Incas, for instance, and they've built cities up on top of mountains that we just marvel at today. Archaeologists go down there and they take a look and say, my God, look at these big rocks. I mean, they got rocks down there that they've carved out that weigh tons and tons and tons. How in the hell did these people carve these rocks and then stack them up? What did they pick them up with when they stacked them up? We don't know. Do those people get any credit for that? I have never seen a word of credit given to an Indian for knowing how to stack two rocks on top of each other. And yet, you go down here to South America and you go up here to 15,000 feet in elevation and here sitting on top of a mountain that's just a cliff on both sides, and here's a whole city, a city that held 30,000 people sitting on top of a mountain at 15,000 feet with rocks that weigh tons and tons neatly stacked on top of one another. How'd those people get those rocks up there? We don't know. We ain't got a clue. And we call these people barbarians and savages? No white man's ever built anything like that. Now, it's true the white man went down there and conquered those people. We had a technology, we had a war technology with gunpowder and guns that defeated those people, and we drove them out, and we converted them to Roman Catholicism and taught them Christianity and taught them the white man's ways and so on, and totally divorced those people. We took all of their books, all of their histories, all of their records, and burned them. That's so that the natives down there would not know where their roots were, and then neither do we. We haven't got clues to where those people came from. But we're convinced that over 12, 21, or 40,000 years, those people came across from Siberia. Now, those people aren't Orientals. Just look at those natives down there. Those are not Oriental features. Now, it's to be sure, there are some Oriental-featured Indians, particularly out in the West Coast, but that doesn't account for 376 Indian tribes here in the United States, many of which were white. All right, now, many thousand years have passed before they spread over North and South America. Actually, a significant number of archaeologists believe that people reached most parts of the Americas within 1,000 years, too rapidly to allow easy archaeological determination of the direction and timing of their migration. They did not know that they were exploring a new continent, American history goes on to tell us, offering no evidence upon which to infer these early Americans' alleged ignorance of what they were investigating. Now, how the hell would we know? Now, here's a statement from a history textbook. It says the Indians, now these are speaking of the Indians that crossed the land bridge from Siberia to Alaska. It says here, they did not know that they were exploring a new continent. And I'm going to underline that. Let's think about that for a minute. How do we know that these people who came across that land bridge did not know that they were exploring a new continent? And that's what we call drawing facts from insufficient evidence. I don't know what the hell those people knew. And I don't know when they came across this mythical land bridge. We suppose there was a land bridge. Now, it's really not very far from Siberia over to Alaska. And American Eskimos and Indians, I don't know why we distinguish Eskimos and Indians or native peoples, but one group we call Indians, another group we call Eskimos. Those people to this day, as I speak, have their own kayaks. They have their own ocean-going boats that they get into on the Alaska side and row across to Siberia. And there are Siberian Indians and Eskimos that get in their kayaks over there in Siberia and row over to Alaska. Hell, they're still doing that today. I don't even know if they've got passports, for crying out loud. Now, our history textbooks tell us that these people were so primitive and they were so dumb and they were so backward that they couldn't get across that 40 miles of water, without a land bridge. They don't need a land bridge today. They didn't need it 100, 200, 300, or 500 years ago. I don't know why they needed it 20,000 years ago. See, we go to school and we read these textbooks. I read that. I believed it when I went to high school. I believed that this is the story that I was presented with. Now I'm an old man and I look at this and I say, well, they did not know that they were exploring a new continent. I don't know that. And the guy that wrote that in that textbook, he hadn't got a clue. He didn't know that either. He wrote it. Students, who are 15, 18 years old, they're going to read that and they're going to believe it because, well, why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they believe it? But my question is, why should we teach that to our children? Now, you send your kid to a public school, if you're average, normal. And your child is being taught these mythical lies, these Mr. Rogers neighborhood stories that aren't true. And then, of course, your child and you and I and everybody else, we develop a picture of history. We develop a view of world history based upon these lies, these stories. And then our politicians are able to maneuver us, manipulate us into going to war. And we love it. It's like World War II, those dirty Japs over there. Truth of the matter is the Japanese weren't any threat to the Americans. And they weren't causing us any grief at all. But they were causing grief to a group of Americans called bankers. And they were cutting off very valuable banking connections, raw material connections, manufacturing connections. In other words, the Japanese were screwing up American commerce. Not that it bothered you or me, but it bothered Chase Manhattan Bank, and it bothered the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and others. And so, when it comes to war, you don't find Rothschilds and Rockefellers out there fighting in the trenches. And, it's Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife that are out there fighting the wars. Always remember that. Remember Smedley Butler explained that to you. Now, American history goes on offering no evidence upon which to infer these early Americans' alleged ignorance. The depiction of mental torpor persists as American history continues. None of the groups made much progress in developing simple machines or substituting mechanical or even animal power for their own muscle power in Europe and Asia. Most pre-1492 machines depended on horses, oxen, water buffalo, mules or cattle, beasts that were unknown in the Americas after all. Now, let's stop and think about that statement. Here are the history books saying, these American Indians are really dumb, just dumb. And they don't have any machines, like us smart whites in Europe. Well, I don't know what they had, because we whites, when we got over here, took all of their written materials and destroyed them. But I just pointed out, they're down in Mexico City, 40 miles south of Mexico City, there are two big pyramids down there. Those two big pyramids are the size of the pyramids over in Giza, Egypt. I mean, they're humongous. They're called the Pyramid of the Sun, the Pyramid of the Moon. I walked up to the top of the Pyramid of the Sun. My God, the blocks of rock are 3 feet high. And those people put that up there. Now, I don't know how they put it up there, but they didn't put it up with horses because there weren't any horses in the Americas. The Spanish brought the horses over here, remember? And so here's a history textbook. Now, listen to what it's telling your student in high school. It says, the depiction of mental torpor, that is stupidity, persists as American history continues, It says, quote, none of the groups made much progress in developing simple machines or substituting mechanical or even animal power for their own muscle power, unquote. Well, excuse me. Can you then tell me how they built cities that had millions of people and populations and irrigation canals that went for hundreds of miles in Yucatan and Mexico, and how they built cities up on top of mountain peaks, and how they built pyramids in Illinois? Can you explain that? The story that American Indians are a bunch of dumb savages running around here, it is true. And more likely, there were some dumb savage tribes of Indians running around on the North American continent. Just like there are a bunch of dumb whites running around on the North American continent. But the dumb whites that are running around in North America don't represent the whole now, do they? Everywhere in the world, there's a bunch of dumb savages. But I don't think that... Now, do you think that welfare people in Harlem would qualify as being dumb brute savages? What do they contribute to society? And yet we don't sit here and say, well, we got a bunch of dumb brute savages in America today, now, do we? Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the law our website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour, an editorial review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. However, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about lies. My teacher told me, if you'd like a copy of the book, it's an eye-opener. It's not the only eye-opener. I've reported on this from time to time from other authors, but this one's a funny book. It's got a lot of humor to it, and it's got a lot of neat questions that are just hang right out there in your face. Like the question that I just raised, I mean, you know, they depict the American Indian as being kind of a dumb savage without any mechanical knowledge, without any building knowledge and so on. And yet all over North and South America are wondrous works. Wondrous. For instance, did you know down in Casa Grande, Arizona, there's an irrigation system down there? I mean, it's miles and miles long, an irrigation system. And the Indians down there were living there in this Casa Grande Valley, they call it in Arizona. And these irrigation canals are there to this day. And I mean, I don't know if there's hundreds of miles of them, but there's many, many, many miles of them. How the hell did those people dig those irrigation canals, and how did they level that up without a transit? I mean, it's like looking at the Great Pyramid. You know, did you know that the Great Pyramid over in Egypt, this is kind of an interesting story, it's built on 14 acres, so the base of the pyramid is 14 acres in size. Well, if you take a small city block, that's 14 small city blocks. Isn't that just kind of special? And did you know that thing is perfectly level, as level as our instruments today can depict it, and that the four corners are plus or minus 1/2 inch on square? Hell, the Empire State Building isn't that square. Did you know that? I mean, it's pretty square, but it's plus or minus 1/2 inch. Generally speaking, I'm living in a house that's 40 by 50 feet, and it's 2 inches out of square. 2 inches, which is no big deal. I mean, you know, 2 inches out of square out of 40 or 50 feet doesn't amount to very much, but you know, the bigger these buildings get, the more accurate they have to be. And did you know the Great Pyramid is built with expansion blocks in it to compensate for the temperature rise and fall overnight as the sun shines on it? It warms up and expands. Did you know that? Now, that took some engineering skill. Well, did you know that there's two big pyramids that are built down in Mexico that are built just like that? Now, boys and girls, let's think about this for a minute. Whoever built those pyramids over there, whether they're Aztecs or Incas or Mayans or whoever the hell they are, you know, Arapaho or Apaches or whoever, that is some kind of technology there, don't you think? So to depict these people, or all of them, you know, is just being kind of dumb, you know, brute savages, kind of like Neanderthals, kind of walking around in the fog, hitting women over the head and dragging them off into the cave to breed them, you know, isn't exactly what we see in the physical evidence that's all around us. Now, it was a tragedy that our forefathers came in here, killed these people, and destroyed their cultures and destroyed their written records. It would be kind of handy today if we could go back in these ancient old written records and read them and find out, well, how these people do this. You know, if nothing else, just out of curiosity. Let's take a look at another one over here. Now, we looked at the Louisiana Purchase. Do you remember the defeat of the Indians at the Little Bighorn? Remember Custer? And, you know, we have these stories running around over here. These Indians over here, you know, they weren't much in the way of fighting. They weren't much. Well, let's take a look here and take a look at some of these Indian wars. This is kind of a fascinating story here. New England's first Indian war was called the Pequot War of 1636-37. It provides a case study of the intensified warfare Europeans brought to America, allied with the Narragansetts, traditional enemies of the Pequots. The colonists attacked at dawn, surrounding the Pequot village, whose inhabitants were mostly women, children, and old men. The British set the village on fire and shot those who tried to escape the flames. William Bradford describes the scene. Quote, "It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire and the streams of blood quenching the fire, and horrible was the stink and the scent thereof. But the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave praise thereof to God, who had wrought so wonderfully for them. The slaughter shocked the Narragansetts, who had wanted merely to subjugate the Pequots, not exterminate them. The Narragansetts reproached the English for their style of warfare, crying, it is not, because it is too furious and slays too many men. In turn, Captain John Underhill scoffed, saying that the Narragansett style of fighting was more for pastime than to conquer and subdue enemies. Underhill's analysis of the role of warfare in Narragansett society was correct, and might accurately be applied to other tribes as well. Through the centuries, whites frequently accused their Native American allies of not fighting hard enough. The Puritans, for instance, tried to erase the Pequots, even from memory, passing a law making it a crime to say the word Pequot. Bradford concluded proudly, quote, "The rest are scattered, and the Indians in all quarters are so terrified that they're afraid to give them sanctuary." None of these quotations enters our textbooks, which devote an average of 1.25 sentences to this war. So out of 12 textbooks, you get one sentence concerning the Pequot War and the violence of it. Now, if you people out there in the rest of the world are wondering how violent the white man is, boy, this is a book that will give you an eye-opener. I knew that our American history was pretty violent, but we whites are violent to the extreme. And it carries over into our streets today, the gang wars that we see in Phoenix, Arizona, and New York City. It's just a part and parcel of white society. We whites are very violent people. But that's not what Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street and Barney portray when we're raising these children, when we send these children to our public schools, and we sanitize our history and our violent past. We picture ourselves as being nice guys, camera-toting, gum-chewing American tourists who are just having a good time until we go to war. Now, you take a look at World War II. Now, that was a pretty violent war, fought among white people, primarily white people. And you take a look at the ferocity of the battles. You know, take Dresden. You know, we white Anglo-Saxons went over to Dresden and we killed tens of thousands of people in a firestorm. Now, you know, we take a look and think, oh my God, if you actually look at the Dresden story, you can pick that up. You know, go to a Google search and get Dresden. There's eyewitness histories of it. You won't read about that in your public school. I never heard a word about Dresden when I went to public school. But it depicts the violent side of the English and Americans who were giving payback to the English who firebombed London in 1940. So, you know, the Americans and the British will say, hey, wake up, smell the coffee. Who was it that came up with this firestorm program to start with? Well, it was the Germans, and it didn't work. You know, they tried to firebomb England. They tried to do to the English what the English succeeded in doing to the Germans. You know, that's the kind of thing that doesn't even enter into the minds of normal people. The average black man or the average Indian man, whether he's from India or from the United States, wouldn't even think. It wouldn't enter his mind. You know, you take flying airplanes into the trade towers. When I saw that, to my mind, it was just unimaginable that that could be done on purpose. The first one, I thought, oh, my God, an airline. Those buildings are so damn high that an airliner flew into it in the fog. That happened in World War II. A B-25 bomber flew into the Empire State Building in World War II, about 1945, as I recall. It was an accident, but, you know, nevertheless, you know, things like that happen. That's what I thought would happen until the second one hit, and then I said, oh, my God, who would have thought such a thing? Who could have dreamed up such wickedness and evil? Well, you know, you got to go to the Bible and have God tell you that the carnal mind is enmity against God and it isn't subject to the law of God, and that the mind of man is wicked and evil continually. We just sit here and work hard at dreaming up how wicked and evil we can be. I hadn't thought much about it, you know, one way or the other, until I picked up the lies our teacher told me. And all of a sudden I say, oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. I've heard about that. So here's this Pequot War. This is 1636-37. This is the first big Indian War. Now, this is just, you know, 17 years after the Pilgrims landed. And, you know, the Pequots over here helped the Puritans get, the Pilgrims, rather, not Puritans, no, the Pilgrims get started, fed them, and sold them land, and we're pretty decent people. Now, the whites come along and say, okay, well, now that we've got the power, now we need to exercise that power, and we need to exterminate these people. So we went out there and exterminated them. Wasn't exactly a fair fight either. We attacked them in the dark, early in the morning. It was a sneak attack, just like the Japanese did in Pearl Harbor. Remember how you Americans felt? Why, those dirty Japs, why they attacked us? It was a sneak attack. Hell, sneak attack, boys and girls, is the heart and soul of war. You always attack your enemy when he isn't expecting it. You always do a sneak attack. Every single time. It's the way war is conducted. Now, of course, that isn't the way it's portrayed, you know. So what we're being fed, what we're being taught, is something different than reality. Now, perhaps the most violent Indian War began in 1676, when white New Englanders executed 3 Wampanoag Indians and the Wampangos attacked. It was called King Philip's War. One reason for the end of peace was that the fur trade, which had linked natives and Europeans economically, was winding down in Massachusetts. Textbooks could present students with the native side of this conflict by quoting the Wampanoag leader, Metta Comet, whom the English called King Philip. So here's this Indian, and his name is Metta Comet, and the English called him King Philip. And here's what this Indian said. He said, "The English who first came to this country were but a handful of people. They were forlorn, they were poor, and they were distressed. My father was then the Sachem." I guess that Sachem would mean the chief of the tribe. "He was the Sachem. He relieved their distresses in the most kind and hospitable manner. He gave them land to plant and build upon. The white man flourished and increased. By various means, they got possessed of a great part of the territory. But he still remained their friend until he died. Then my older brother became the Sachem, and he was seized and confined, and thereby thrown into illness and died. Soon after, I became the Sachem, and they disarmed all of my people. Our land was taken, but a small part of the dominion of my ancestors remains, and I am determined not to live until I have no country." Unquote. Well, now there's a piece of the history or a piece of the story that I didn't know, and so I thought I would reveal that to you. I'd share it with you. The Indians befriended the Puritans, not Puritans, the Pilgrims, rather, Pilgrims now. They sold them land and worked with them until 1676, and then when the white man got established, he turned on his Indians, on his benefactors, and killed them all. Well, didn't quite kill all of them, there's still a few of them left, but destroyed them. Now, that's been the white man's tactic, you know, befriend them and get in there with them. It's called a fifth column. And then when they're not expecting it, then destroy them. The communists are great at that. They're wonderful. They've taken that right out of the white man's book. And so, you know, if you think that the Chinese are bad guys because they're taking a page out of the white man's book, remember who did it first. It's kind of like the Dresden bombing. You know, you Germans over there, well, who came up with this firestorm war idea first? It was the Germans. Did it to the English in London, and it didn't work. So the English took a look at it and said, well, how can we improve upon this neat German idea for burning people alive in their cities? And let's see if we can improve upon it. And they did. It happened in February of 1945. Now get this. By February of 1945, boys and girls, Germany was a beaten nation. They hadn't given up yet, but, you know, by May 5th. Now this is February. I forgot the exact date, but this is February. March, April. I mean, the war is only going to last another 60 or 70 days. There was as much need, there was as much reason for that Dresden bombing as there was, or there is, for driving down the street and shooting people off the street corners, which gang members do regularly. It has no purpose whatsoever. It isn't going to alter the outcome of World War II. And the people that are living in Dresden are not soldiers. They're mainly women and children and old men and old ladies. The civilian population of Dresden, Germany. But, you know, the Germans came up with this firebomb idea, and before the war ended, see, while there was still an excuse, it was just revenge, is what it really boils down to, it was Winston Churchill's idea. I mean, Winston Churchill said, we're going to pay these Huns back for what they did to us in 1940, which was a failed firebomb attack on London. That killed a bunch of people, but it didn't kill anywhere near the number of people that were killed in Dresden. And so the British and Americans carried out this firebomb war policy on Dresden, and I forgot how many people are killed, but it was many, many thousands of people burned to death in the firestorm in February 1945. Now, had they done it earlier on in the war, they could have had some justification. Hey, it was a technique or a tactic in war, like firebombing Tokyo in 1945. Now, that firebombing of Tokyo had more relevance. You know, we were trying to get the Japanese to give up and quit. The Germans were already beaten. Well, they were beaten in December of 1944 at the Battle of the Bulge. That was the last offensive battle that the Germans participated in. That was the end of it. From then on, it was all over. They should have quit, you know, the day after the Battle of the Bulge, you know, about January 1st of 1945. They should have woke up one day and said, well, okay, that's all we've got. There's no point in going on killing people anymore. The war's lost. Let's figure out how to stop this. They didn't. And so the Americans and the Britons, I guess, they just said, okay, well, now watch what we're going to do. Now, the normal people in the world, and I'm going to use normal, that's all the rest of you people out there in the world, you have not come up yet. Your brains, your minds have not come up with the kind of wickedness and evil that we white Anglo-Saxons can come up with. I mean, we are the champions of violence. If you people want to get violent with us, you know, get after it. But we are, without a doubt, the champions of violence. Here's another story over here. This is the New England War. This is on page 110. Now, there was no minor war. This was no minor war. Of some 90 Puritan towns, 52 had been attacked and 12 destroyed. At the end of the war, several thousand English and perhaps twice as many Indians lay dead. King Philip's war cost more American lives in combat. That is, Anglo-Saxon and native lives in combat, in this war, in 1676, in absolute terms, than the French and Indian War, the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and the Mexican War or the Spanish-American War all combined. Hold it, boys and girls. I want you to listen to that one again. This is important. This war in 1676 between the whites in New England, in Massachusetts, and the Pequot Indians killed more people than the following five wars combined. It killed more people than the French and Indian War, the American Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, and the Spanish-American War combined. If you took all of the people killed in those five wars, on both sides combined, it was fewer people in total than the Pequot War, or what's known as King Philip's War, in 1676 in absolute terms. And how many pages are devoted to that war in our American history books? 1 1/4 pages on average. That's not an accident. It's done on purpose to cast the white man in a more favorable light as not being a wicked, evil, violent person. And I just wanted to reveal to you that the white man is the most violent, wicked, evil person God ever put breath into. And if you can point in history to any group of people that are more wicked, more evil, more violent, more murderous than the white man, send me an email and I'll broadcast it for you. Name one group of people more violent than the whites. And while you're at it, send me an example of how they did that. And how many people did they kill? And that was in 1676, boys and girls. That was just about 56 years after the Pilgrims landed that they did that. In 56 years. That was a bloodbath. And we didn't know anything about it now, did we? Now, there's more to come. I want to give you the name and address here again. This is called Lies My Teacher Told Me, and it's a whitewash of U.S. American history, written by James W. Lowen, L-O-E-W-E-N. And the guy's pretty upfront and says, hey, did you know this? Well, the information's there. It's on the shelves, but you've got to go dig it out. But they present it in our history textbooks and stick it right in front of our face and then lie to us. Just thought I'd let you know. All right, let me give you a final reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Remember, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. And all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.